The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right, thank you, comrades. I'm going to be the presenter who reads directly from my computer. I'm so sorry. I'm getting over a cold and I have an ear infection, so if I sound like I'm yelling at you, it's because I'm half deaf. So, so again, welcome to our talk on not-for-profit, the nonprofit industrial complex. I am a former nonprofit worker from Columbus, Ohio, where I previously worked in a variety of nonprofit capacities for 6 years, including 3 stints as an AmeriCorps member, working on the Ohio Democratic Party payroll to re-elect a U.S. senator before I was a radical. Maybe I'll tell you which one later if you ask nicely. And most recently, I was a program supervisor for the implementation of welfare reform, which is as bad as it sounds, and that's why I quit my day job in September of last year. So I have a personal interest in exploring the limitations of nonprofit models of charity and activism as a young worker who has both worked within the social services sector and has also been a recipient of services and outreach offered by them. I'm sure as many of you in this room may know, those of us who graduated after the 2008 recession encountered an even more hostile job market than typical, leading many of us to take low-wage jobs in a variety of underpaid fields, including, and it seems especially sometimes, nonprofit capacities. To illustrate this point, I was surprised and then immediately not surprised to learn that young college graduates were the number one demographic to receive Thanksgiving food boxes from a local resource center in my relatively affluent neighborhood in Columbus. But it doesn't matter if I'm college educated or not, young or old, white, black, Somali, Latina, or any other demographic. Why is it that I should have to rely on the charity and beneficence of others for food, shelter, or clothing? Particularly in a large and wealthy society as Columbus, or in Chicago, or in LA, or wherever that is for that matter. These basic necessities should be human rights, full stop. My wages should be more than enough to cover their costs. If I'm unable to work for whatever reason, these necessities should be provided to me out of the surplus of our collective labor from my society. And that is the thesis of my argument tonight, and coincidentally, that's why I'm a socialist, and I think that you should be one too. So I'm gonna back up a little bit and explain to you what Erica and I intend to do in this about 40-minute talk. In the first section, I want to define capitalism, socialism, nonprofits, and the nonprofit industrial complex. A lot to cover. I will also explore the purposes and limitations of foundations and foundation funding of nonprofits. Erica will then take over to discuss grassroots or so-called locally based or maybe not so locally based nonprofit activism and the ideology that's perpetuated by the nonprofit industrial complex. And finally, she will also talk about the anti-capitalist strategy to solving the problems facing our world and what that would look like. So we do have a lot of ground to cover, so forgive us if we leave something out that you wanted to talk about. There'll be plenty of time to raise additional points in the discussion period. So first of all, I want to share with you some definitions so we're all working from a common starting point. So capitalism, as I will use it in this talk, is an economic and political system in which a small handful of very wealthy individuals control the majority of wealth produced by a society. These individuals own what we call the means of production, the fields in which food is grown, the coffee machines at Starbucks, the t-shirt presses, the trucks that deliver goods produced by other workers on other machinery, and the reservoir of reserve capital, or money, which they can use to buy equipment and supplies, pay workers before profits are realized from a day's labor, etc. They own this machinery, these buildings, the capital, or access to capital, and other supplies. And I think that even a capitalist would agree with that definition, even if some of them may not appreciate it being reminded of these facts, but many others, of course, take pride in it. For specifically a Marxist analysis, however, we argue that they also own the current and potential labor of the workers who create the products and services that we consume, and it is because our labor is purchased in advance that we have no control over it and we feel alienated from it. So that's basically like wage labor and capital by Marx in a nutshell, which is an excellent foundation for understanding capitalism and socialism, and actually highly relevant to a discussion about nonprofits, believe it or not. I also would like to recommend Leela's talk from last year on capitalism and alienation if you're interested in learning more about that. So then we define socialism as an economic and political system in which everyone owns an equal share of the means of production and receives an equal share of the wealth that their labor produces, or they receive an equal share regardless of their ability to produce, as would be the case with the young, the elderly, or the disabled. Like I said before, this is why I'm a socialist. So, you know, this is not the talk about strategy to achieve that particular goal, but it is a place to talk about do nonprofits service that goal or do they not? So this position, though, informs all of my political activism, my interactions with others, my work as a nonprofit worker, and the points I'll be making for the remainder of my section of this talk. So now let me define nonprofit for you. And this one is so much easier than trying to define capitalism and socialism. A simple definition would be any non-governmental organization, also known as an NGO, which provides some kind of good or service. That's it. But that sounds like a definition for any company, right? Like, that could apply to a for-profit company. So as you may know, since you walked into this room, nonprofit is a bit of a misnomer. While most nonprofits don't sell or goods or services for which they receive payments directly from consumers or recipients of those goods or services, they receive payment in the form of foundation and government grants, private donations from individuals, and other fundraising efforts, legal or otherwise. Some nonprofits are bringing in quite a bit of profit, actually, as Erica will talk about later, which is contrary to what their tax status implies. Nonprofits also include a diverse array of organizations and companies, which include but are not limited to churches, food pantries, political organizations, clinics, or other usual kind of suspects. But unions are also nonprofit entities, as well as political parties like the Democratic Party and Republican Party, think tanks like the Heritage Foundation or ALEC, and most hospitals, universities, and even private charter schools. Even companies you would think that would be for-profit entities such as the American Chemical Society has nonprofit status due to its scientific research purpose. Nonprofits have different tax classifications which define not only their tax-exempt status, but also the scope of their work in many cases. The most common designations are 501c3 for service providers, 501c4 for political activism, 501c6 for unions. And I know that I nerd out about tax statuses for nonprofits, but I assume most of you do not, so we can talk about that after the section is over. But for the purpose of this talk, we will primarily focus on 501c3 service providing organizations, 501c4 political organizations, and philanthropic foundations which offer competitive grant funding to nonprofits which are designated by any of the aforementioned, or either of the aforementioned classifications. So then what is the nonprofit industrial complex? You may be familiar with the term military industrial complex, which was coined by Dwight D. Eisenhower regarding the profit motive in World War II, or the prison industrial complex, or even the academic industrial complex. There are common threads linking each of these terms, though they are also knitted together in the fabric of society under capitalism. Modern day neoliberalism cannot exist without the profit motive present in perpetual war and occupation, hyper-exploitation of unpaid and underpaid slavery in the prison system, and without the academic arms race driving down the cost of wages for academics while driving up the demands on their time and labor. And more, of course, but these are just a few of the named industrial complexes that share common elements with the nonprofit industrial complex, or NPIC. Much of the information from our talk has been drawn from this book titled, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded by the Insight Collective. Their definition of the nonprofit industrial complex, in short, is a system of relationships between the state or local and federal governments, the owning classes, foundations, and nonprofit/NGO social service and social justice organizations. That defines the complex, but does not expound on the ramifications for this type of system under the present incarnation of capitalism. So they also quote from a contributor to the book, Dylan Rodriguez, who defines the NPIC as a set of relationships that link political and financial technologies of state and class control over public political ideology, including and especially emergent progressive and leftist social movements. That definition is highly relevant to the NGOification of movements such as the Movement for Black Lives, LGBT liberation, reproductive rights, and even refugee and immigration assistance. This definition also connects the surveillance and control aspects of the nonprofit model to service, as recipients also often have to meet specific eligibility and respectability requirements in order to qualify for aid, including sometimes literal surveillance by either a nonprofit worker or even the state. Over the past 40 to 50 years, the ruling class in this country, but also all over the globe, has executed a concerted attack on public services and works, regulation, job security, and other rights and benefits that were fought for and won by earlier generations. This is what we call neoliberalism, which is like normal capitalism, but cranked up to 11. This attack on the working class and the social safety net means that more and more workers and their families must turn to charitable nonprofits, as well as the few remaining public benefits offered by the government, relying more and more on the kindness of others. As socialists, we believe that instead of kindness or philanthropy, we require material solidarity to solve these problems. But I'm not going to steal that part from Erica's talk, so you have something to look forward to at the end. So that is a lot of definitions that I just threw at you. So I want to give us maybe like a 3-minute break to turn and talk to your neighbor and try to either define some of these terms in your own words, like what is the nonprofit industrial complex, or come up with maybe a question that you have about it based off of what you walked in, the experience that you walked into the room with, or something that came up in this part of the talk. So we'll give you like maybe 3 minutes to turn to your neighbor and talk. Half the time, so okay. So I hope that was productive. Sorry to cut you off. But the last thing that I want to talk about in my section of the presentation tonight is how nonprofits get the majority of their funding if they aren't selling commodities or services for profit. So this explanation will also illustrate why it is that one of the main sponsors of this conference, the Center for Economic Research and Social Change, CERSC, which is the parent organization for Haymarket Books, does not seek grants from foundations, but instead relies on the sales of books, but more importantly, the fundraising efforts of members of the ISO and our allies. So this is also a kickoff pitch for CERSC fundraising, comrades, so you better get on it, I'm just saying. No, but the majority of nonprofit funding comes in the form of grants from charitable foundations. Foundations are tax havens for the wealthy to sit on reserves of excess capital, excess money, to invest in the market and increase its amount, and then to invest in hand-selected nonprofits, which are often connected by family or business ties to these foundations. Not always, but often. You might have some awareness that this has happened with the Trump Foundation or the Clinton Foundation, but we can talk about those examples and others in the discussion. So your nonprofit may win a grant, and I say win because it is a competition that we're putting nonprofits into competition with one another instead of working together. But the funding is still not guaranteed, as the Insight Collective discovered the hard way when the Ford Foundation withdrew funding over the Insight Collective's position on Palestine, or as my partner found out when he was laid off from his CNCS-funded job last year, despite being awarded a grant for that current fiscal year. It just, like, hits home, right? Like, it just shows. Erica's going to talk a little bit more about what it means to be a nonprofit worker, but as a former one myself, my partner's a former one, like, this actually affects our lives. The Ford Foundation is also responsible, as another example, they're also responsible for crushing revolutionary movements, particularly by funding pro-capitalist elements during the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. And we see this now with NGOs that receive funding for a variety of contemporary issues, from NGOs promoting a dialogue for a two-state solution for occupied Palestine, or to the racist pro-eugenics organization Population Connection, which funds reproductive rights campaigns such as Fight for Her on college campuses. Grants also come with strings attached. Some are visible, like reporting requirements, but others may be invisible, like the example of Palestine I mentioned a moment ago, or may even be contingent on who runs the nonprofit, who writes the grant, who administers it, etc. I don't have a snappy quote to leave you with, so I'm just going to let Erica take it away from here. This is going to make a ton of noise.
Hi, comrades. Thank you, Emily, for kicking it off. So as has been laid out throughout this conference, average Americans are being squeezed harder and harder in their daily lives. And as government programs, social services, and general safety net programs that typically benefit poor and working class people are cut due to austerity measures and neoliberalism, nonprofits often fill those gaps. So in my section, I'm gonna dive into talking about service nonprofits. These institutions are the ones that maybe are what you think of when you hear the word nonprofit, and maybe the ones that you've come across either working for them or in your activism maybe. And there's a really wide range of types of nonprofits in this category. So it could be providing beds to homeless people or tutoring kids after school or more advocacy focused like Greenpeace. So Emily laid out foundations and their relation to the nonprofit industrial complex. And obviously foundations and service nonprofits are related. Service nonprofits get much of their funding from these foundations, and then, you know, foundations look really good when they, you know, fund all of these services. State, counties, and cities often also contract out their services to nonprofits, and so I think we can understand the nonprofit industrial complex to include, like, these, you know, service nonprofits, these, you know, philanthropic foundations, and then also like state and government services. So this nonprofit complex is very complicated. There are a web of organizations and foundations that all rely on each other. So quickly, I'm gonna talk about the United Way. I don't know if people have heard of this nonprofit. It's the largest privately funded nonprofit in the world, according to its website. And according to its website, quote, they create solutions that build stronger communities. And that's one trend you see a lot in the nonprofit industrial complex, just like very vague wording, like I don't know what they do. What I did find out from their website, however, is their CEO, Brian Gallagher, his total compensation for 2016 was $1.2 million. Great, wow, we don't need that money. This includes, so his base salary is $500,000. And then he got over $150,000 in bonuses and incentive compensation. And then at the end of 2016, he got a 3% raise, so awesome. Great. And so that is the largest privately funded nonprofit in the world. So I think that just kind of lays the scene for what nonprofits stand for. So like Emily, I'm gonna actually have you turn to your neighbor, and whatever you all are talking about, please definitely share those experiences in the discussion at the end. But I wanna have you all turn to talk to each other about if you do work for a nonprofit, share, you know, what that experience is like, and then also if you've come across nonprofits in your activism, like what has that been like? Yeah, so I'll give you like a couple more minutes. 3 minutes. A show of hands, who in this room works for a nonprofit right now? Oh my gosh, so many people. I'm sorry? Do public schools count? No. But I'm sure a lot of the experiences apply to working at a public school. So I'm hoping some of the things I lay out in this section really resonate with people who work at nonprofits right now. So the first thing I'm gonna talk about is the professionalization of nonprofits. So there are advanced degrees in, you know, nonprofit management. There are masters in business schools that have, you know, concentrations in like philanthropy and things like that. And then there are also degrees you need to have to be able to bill for certain services to receive that funding from, you know, Medicaid or the federal government or things like that. Foundations as well can put whatever stipulations they want in their grants. And so presumably they could require a certain program, everyone in that program to have a PhD in psychology, even if it's not, you know, clinically necessary. And this trend creates a stratification between nonprofit employees and the clients they serve, and almost guarantees that clients of these nonprofits will not have the chance to one day become service providers. And this is a shame, because the people who experience these social problems should be the ones helping to craft the solutions, or I think so. So I would argue that these certificate programs or master's degrees, the curriculum that's being written in these programs, could also be considered part of this nonprofit industrial complex. So that's just another Venn diagram to put. Now I'm going to go into the ideology of nonprofits. And I'm going to talk a lot about ideas that are in this book by Don Lash, When the Welfare People Come. And if people haven't read it, it's just like so amazing. And I really recommend it. And I'm going to kind of just steal the argument that Don Lash makes. But he talks a lot about Antonio Gramsci, who is an Italian Marxist, and how his ideas relate to the child welfare system. And I think the connections that Don Lash makes also apply a lot to the nonprofit industrial complex. So Gramsci lays out what he calls the coercive state or political society. These words kind of mean the same thing. And these are institutions that enforce decisions when consent is not obtained. So courts that, you know, tell you have to do something, the police that come and take you when you don't do that thing, incarceration. And the coercive state is manifested in the nonprofit industrial complex for mandated reporters when we are forced to make a CPS report. Do people know what a mandated reporter is? Like, raise your hand if you know what that is. Basically, it just means that you are an employee who, if you hear something, you legally have to make a CPS report. And again, this is stipulated by the government, by laws, but also a grant from any kind of philanthropic fund can just say that everyone at this nonprofit is a mandated reporter. And as Don Lash lays out in his book, the child welfare system is a way to regulate and surveil the poor, and isn't really about justice for families. This coercive state is also manifested when we are forced to call the police. So one example is maybe you work at a drug rehab center and they don't allow children, only adult men. And this, again, this stipulation could just be because you got one grant that says you can only have adult men in your center. And maybe a man comes with his daughter. And so you have to ask him to leave, essentially making the family homeless. If he refuses, you then have to call the cops, making this father a criminal. And that's a really specific example, and this is kind of a worst case scenario. And more often than not, nonprofits are engaging in the idea of the civil society. And so what Gramsci means when he says civil society is, again, like institutions and programs that reinforce the hegemonic or dominant ideology in society. So nonprofits in the services they give, again, like in maybe the curriculum they write, in the media campaigns they might design for whoever, they reinforce and perpetuate certain ideas, and they frame what is an appropriate solution to certain social problems. For some reason, I feel like I'm using homelessness a lot in a lot of these examples, just because it's just so, works really well. And also, I'm from the Bay Area where homelessness is really, really rampant. So nonprofits, just by, again, their existence or maybe the things that they explicitly or implicitly say, frame that a solution to homelessness is homeless shelters, rather than maybe homeless people organizing themselves. Or that the solution to political problems is like Greenpeace lobbying for you rather than, say, occupying Congress until all your demands are met. And they also frame what is the most appropriate way to go about bringing change, and that's namely working for a nonprofit. And you know, who benefits when goodwilled political people get involved in a system that incentivizes not rocking the boat? Capitalism. So this ideology is necessary to justify the use of coercion and force, if and when it is used. So because there's kind of this dominant idea about how to solve homelessness, when the police are called on homeless people who are organizing themselves, or when they're in a neighborhood that they're not supposed to be, and there's a homeless sweep and all their stuff gets taken away by the police. That's kind of, that force is justified by this ideology. And I know this is kind of like theory heavy stuff, and I really want people to, if they have questions, bring them out in the discussion. So the organizations perpetuating this ideology, the trainings and curriculum being written, all of these are often all nonprofits. This can illuminate what we mean when we say a nonprofit industrial complex. The web of nonprofits that all interact at different points to maintain the current system, perpetuate ideology, and when need be, justify the invocation of coercive and violent elements of the state. And so that's kind of the ideological basis of nonprofits. Now I'm going to shift into being a nonprofit worker. This section in my Google Docs is just titled Workers in all caps. If you work in a nonprofit, you might be a therapist or a fundraiser or an administrative assistant, but you're also a worker. And I want to share a few examples of nonprofits rejecting their benevolent facade to show their kind of more capitalist ways. So have people heard of the Whittier Street Health Center in Boston? This is a health center that was written about in Socialist Worker, the ISO's newspaper. And workers won their fight for a union. One worker said, quote, "Many of us were victims of wage theft unless we noticed the errors in our pay. We were often not paid in a timely manner for vacation, sick, or bereavement time, despite it being approved. We would have to constantly check our pay, and when errors were noted, and only if they were noted, we would be paid, but only after arguing with management." Nonprofit workers already get low wages, but having one's wages stolen and requests for time off ignored or dismissed is just a whole nother level of injustice. It should also be noted that the CEO at this health center makes $500,000. And when these workers tried to unionize, the management hired an anti-union lawyer whose law firm website boasts, quote, "having helped dozens of employers successfully defeat union organizing drives." And so this is what bosses at nonprofits do. On June 20th, 20 workers at this clinic were fired in the blink of an eye. Like, people showed up to work, put their badges on the door, and like couldn't get in. The behavioral health department shrank by 2/3, like at the drop of a hat. So the next day, the workers protested outside the clinic, and the day after that, all 20 workers were hired back again. And all of this happened before the union vote. So you can imagine, once the union vote took place, workers voted overwhelmingly to join SEIU Local 1199. Clap it up for unions. So we work in nonprofits out of our deep desire to help people. As a nurse or a clinician or an administrator, these people want to make the world a better place in some way. And it's a shame that when they try to make their own lives better as workers, they're met with resistance from the management. Awesome, thank you. And so while these workers were victorious, others are not so lucky. So Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado actually, again, successfully voted to unionize their workplace. And the bosses at this Planned Parenthood location turned to the Trump National Labor Relations Board. So the bosses at Planned Parenthood said, quote, "We're not currently opposing efforts to organize our affiliate. We have asked the NLRB to consider whether all of our employees should be able to participate." And they argued that the union ought to include all of the clinics in the regional agency, which spans 3 states. And so this is a surefire way to tank the union efforts of these employees and risk setting a bad precedent for unions everywhere. And workers at Planned Parenthood, you know, offered so many times to meet with management to talk this issue out, but the management insisted on turning to the Trump NLRB. So why would they do this? Because under capitalism, there's a fundamental tension between bosses and workers. Workers want their rights respected, and bosses want to tamp down on workers' struggle in any way possible. This is true in factories when workers are making car parts, and it's true at Planned Parenthood when workers are providing healthcare. And one critique I actually have of the term nonprofit industrial complex is it kind of obscures the way that nonprofits are just like any other workplace. You are paid too little, your boss makes way too much, and you're not respected. I'm gonna end with a really awesome badass nonprofit, you know? Like, what do we say about those good nonprofits? And so if people remember, in September 2017, Nancy Pelosi was interrupted by DACA recipients. Do people remember this? I really wish I had the foresight to like bring an AV thing, because I just love seeing capitalists getting yelled at. It just really warms my heart. So they interrupted her in San Francisco demanding a Clean Dream Act, one that includes all 11 million undocumented people in the US and not just good immigrants. And this is something that, as the ISO, we totally agree with and think is fantastic. And the protest was staged by the California Immigrant Youth Justice Alliance. And they are a, quote, semi-independent special project of MALDEF, which is a nonprofit that focuses on Latino legal rights. And so again, you see kind of this weird wording in the nonprofit world, like semi-independent special project. But anyway, these activists in this nonprofit, you know, they interrupted Nancy Pelosi, and then they wrote an op-ed in the Huffington Post where they called out Obama as deporter in chief. You know, they use direct action tactics aimed at politicians. And these are all things that we agree with. And so some on the left might criticize this nonprofit for not addressing capitalist exploitation. And that is true, they don't address it, but that's because they're not meant to. So our contention with nonprofits is not just about the things that they do wrong or that are like problematic, but rather their inherent limitations. Nonprofits address the symptom: racism, anti-immigration policies, lack of healthcare, housing, lack of emotional support for workers, but they don't address the disease, which is capitalism. Nonprofits lead us to a trend of playing whack-a-mole with social problems. And so Paul Kivel in The Revolution Will Not Be Funded says, quote, "When temporary shelter becomes a substitute for permanent housing, emergency food a substitute for a decent job, tutoring a substitute for adequate public schools, and free clinics a substitute for universal healthcare, we have shifted our attention away from the redistribution of wealth to the temporary provision of social services to keep people alive." And this becomes quite apparent, again, to people who work at nonprofits. Every time you know, are on hold forever and finally get a homeless person a bed, there's 10 more people waiting. Once you help secure, you know, tutoring for one kid, there's 10 more. Once you get someone healthcare, there's so many more who need it. It can be really disheartening. And, you know, wanting to work at a nonprofit in order to live a more ethical life is not much more different than wanting to be vegan or live in a co-op. These things are not, you know, bad. They're pretty admirable. You know, if people want to live a good life, we want to encourage that, but they don't cut to the root of the problem. And so we don't advocate for working in a nonprofit over another kind of workplace, but we do advocate for all workers, those at Google, at health clinics, at restaurants, or at homeless shelters, to understand their role in capitalism as workers and to band together and fight. And so I think if capitalist exploitation is the problem you want to solve, and I think we would all here argue that that is the problem you should want to solve, you should join a socialist organization. What a surprise, what a surprising conclusion. It does not mean that nonprofits are horrible or anyone who works at them are not radical enough. I really don't want to frame things that way. But we have to be realistic about the limits of the change that they can bring about. And we have to ask ourselves about the methods of organization that will bring about change and the kind of change we want to see, which is namely an end to oppression and exploitation. So join a socialist organization and cut to the root of the problem, which is capitalism. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.